of machines with almost limitless speed. Each year, they battle for the World Prototype Cup. Opening round, the 24 Hours of Daytona.
This year's race stacks up as a tremendous battle of the brands. Ford, victorious in the three major events last year, is back with the powerful new Mark II prototype. Ferrari here with two blood-red, siren-sounding P4s. And Chaparral of Texas with two different cars, one with a wing relying on Chevrolet power. It's the beginning of a season-long battle for international honors.
I feel that we can have the fastest car here, which, you know, is Ford-powered. We've already proven that. And so we just want to be there at the end of 24 hours and be the first one across the line.
Right now, the Ferrari is a little bit quicker. I don't know what Ford has been doing over the winter. But I have a feeling we can maybe not go any faster than them, but we can do it a little bit easier.
Did Mr. Ferrari give you any specific orders before you came here?
Yes, win.
Phil, which brand is Chaparral concerned with most, Ford or Ferrari?
We're concerned equally with both of them. Ford has the strength in numbers, but Ferrari, you know, when Ferrari ever makes a serious effort like he has this time, unlike last year, you can rest assured that he's going to be a real threat.
Right off the start, Phil Hill stuffed his Brogan into the Chaparral to outburst the Fords and Ferraris and set a blistering, record-setting pace. Suddenly, trouble for Ford. A faulty transmission shaft from a subcontractor spread through the Ford effort like cholera. And Ferrari began to breathe easier. The Park Scarpiotti car led for a while, then alternated with the Eamon Bandini P4 prototype. The McLaren Bianchi Ford was one of only two still circulating of the six-car Ford effort, and it was no match for the Ferrari Raiders. The initial promise of the wing Chaparral was flooded by a wall of dust, and Phil Hill's rising early effort was wiped out. Through the night, the Ferraris traded the lead. The Gurney Foyt Ford worked as high as fourth, but then retired with the Ford transmission problem. By dawn, the Ford pits were strangely vacant. Only McLaren and Bianchi still running. Ferrari had its own way to the finish. The violent Red Raiders from Modena arrogantly lined up three abreast to mimic Ford's finish a year ago at Le Mans. Chris Amon and Lorenzo Bandini were the actual winners, covering more than 2,500 miles. Well, round one of the World Championship for Prototypes and Manufacturers is over. Ford had its troubles, as did Chaparral. Next stop, Sebring, 12 hours. For Sebring, Ford had a brand new mount for its drivers, the Space Age Mark IV. Sleek, light, refined to the nth degree. Bruce McLaren and Mario Andretti quickly stuck it on the pole, but Ferrari abdicated and eliminated Ford's chance for revenge.
As a driver with the fastest car, Bruce, would you wish the Ferraris be here?
Yeah, I'm a little disappointed they're not here because I think that on this circuit with this car, we could have got even for Daytona.
The angry snouts of Ford and Chaparral headed the 60-car lineup for the 12 hours of Sebring. The Le Mans start race was won by a Corvette and several smaller engine speedsters. The huge Fords and Chaparral a bit bulky at the beginning. But before many laps, McLaren had his beast at the head of the pack and showed every intention of staying there. The lone Mark II, Ford's only other entry, was running second. But by the time McLaren came in to hand over to Andretti, the Chaparral was within striking distance and sailed by into the lead. This pattern was to last for six thrilling hours as Ford and Chaparral battled in heroic maneuvers around the 5 2/10 mile airport course. Until, as dust settled, the Chaparral's automatic transmission failed, scrubbing a magnificent effort by Hall and Spence. The Foyt Ruby Mark II filled the second slot to put Ford in command. The Mark IV, with no competition, concentrated on proving itself in its first competitive venture, with Le Mans definitely in the future. The flow of night saw little change in the proceedings, and when the checker flashed through the murky blackness, Fords were still 1-2, the Mark IV
24 had showed itself a thoroughbred and ready for Ferrari's prancing horse, former road racing champ Bob Hobart and the winner.
Mario, can you say a word about this new car? Tell us how you like the performance.
Well, it's fantastic. I think I've been connected with some of the testing that we've been doing with it, and I think finally Ford really come up with a very, very competitive car.
Let me have a word with Bruce McLaren here. Bruce, how do you like this new car and the handling quality?
I like it a lot. It's a great car, no doubt about it. And I think that at Le Mans, we're really going to have a ton of jobs with it.
Le Mans, the rubber match between Ford and Ferrari. Pleased with its Sebring performance, Ford brought six of the new Mark IVs and a bevy of the world's best drivers. Paul Chaparral effort was too strong and potent. Ferrari brought its quick, but most of all reliable, P4. It promised to be a showdown of historic proportions. Ferrari's Mike Park.
Mr. Ferrari told us to go to Daytona and win. Win we did. This means that Ford took a beating. That means that they come back all the harder to try and win here.
Ford's strategy included the so-called Rabbit, a car set out to run the opposition into the ground. On that subject, Dan Gurney.
The driver's meeting with Ford is yet to be held. Do you hope your sign, the Rabbit, kind of work, or would you rather be held?
I just assume be held as far as chances of winning the race, though. I know it's a very long race, and about this time tomorrow is when I like to try and be a rabbit.
More than 300,000 fans eagerly awaited the start of the race that would mythically crown Ford or Ferrari world champion. And a year-old Ford, a Mark II version, led off the grid, followed by a howling horde, all acting as if it was a 200-mile sprint race. The Mark IVs and Ferraris were cautious at the start, the Chaparral slow getting away. Downhill into the S's, Ronnie Bucknum still held the point in his Mark II. An American entered Ferrari second. But as the race developed, so did the Ford promise, and the giant Mark IVs assumed command, setting records at every turn. Into the night they roared. The Dan Gurney, A.J. Foyt, Ford in the lead. Ferrari beginning to catch up. Then in an accident just before 4 a.m., sidelined three of the Fords. No one hurt, but the Ford effort severely hampered. Ferrari were now running second and third. Both Chaparrals had been retired. Ford hopefuls were cheered come dawn by the okay signal from Dan Gurney as he flashed by, still in first. The Donahue McLaren car held gamely onto fourth, but many laps back. In third place at dawn, the Moretz-Gurley's Ferrari was left little option but to hope the Ford would break. The Ferrari team, too, had been decimated. French officiating and was pit-bound seemingly forever as crew members had to use their belts to tie down the bodywork which had blown off when Bruce McLaren was at the wheel. Mark returned to cheers, but now not much help if Gurney and Foyt should break. But they were driving easily and staying in front. The Park Scarpiani P4 was second, unable to improve its position against the Mark IV. Meres and Burley followed dutifully behind in third, and Donahue and McLaren were fourth, hoping now to hold on to the 4 p.m. finish. And the race leaders, as they had been since the first pit stop, A.J. Foyt and Dan Gurney, were able to run well within the car's top speed. They thus also led the fuel efficiency contest. 4 o'clock Sunday. Foyt brought the car majestically across the line for a spectacular Ford triumph, and to the lusty cheers of the spectators, not to mention Ford officials. Ferrari's finished second and third, the Donahue McLaren Ford fourth. Dan Gurney and A.J. Foyt assumed the victor's platform and the accolade they so justly deserved, along with Mr. Henry Ford II. It was the first All-American triumph at Le Mans, and a momentous tribute to man's ability to build that much sophistication into a racing machine and then drive it to its limits, beating the best the world has to offer. In a moment, 1968, the year it all happened. Occasion, 1968 will be the year of revolution. The quiet revolution of the turbine has begun. The hallowed sanctums of international sports prototype racing have been officially opened to turbine power, and they're eligible for the title. The High Bank Super Speedway, venue of the NASCAR heroes, will witness unbelievable jumps in speed as Ford and Chrysler, with their slippery new cars, threaten to make the tracks too slow for the cars. USAC not only will feel the turbine's blast, but road circuits will multiply, and Grand Prix and sports car drivers will try their hand at the Indy car wheel. And finally, McLaren's Orange Demons of the 67 Can-Am series will be antique by the time the opposition finishes readying for this year's go. A late season battle that will be historic. Therefore, it can be said with certainty that racing 1968, in all its thrilling, varied forms, will break through into new worlds of speed and achievement that will mark it as the year it happened for years to come.
Just a small segment of the over 50 million spectators who watch steel-nerved drivers in colorful race machines compete for the checkered flag. Fans of all ages, from every walk of life, have made competition racing one of the world's most popular spectator sports. Many of the power, performance, and safety features we enjoy on our passenger cars were developed through racing. Auto racing is one of the world's best proving grounds for the testing and improvement of tires, spark plugs, motor fuels, lubricants, engines, and safety equipment. After exhaustive laboratory tests, products must prove their performance and stamina on the track in actual competition. The starting point for many young hopefuls is midget racing at tracks like this at Winchester, Indiana. Here, the novice gains valuable experience while competing not only with other rookies, but with professionals as well. The midget is a compact sprint car that usually races on a one-quarter or one-half mile dirt or paved track. Some midget races are held indoors in sports arenas. Only 76 inches long, the midget race car is powered by a 110 to 150 cubic inch engine. Over the years, the Meyer Drake was the favorite power plant, but today, midgets are powered by Buick, Ford, Chevy, and other engines. Midgets provide race fans with a thrilling performance. These are United States Auto Club Championship dirt cars. Top professionals like Mario Andretti, A.J. Foyt, and Parnelli Jones keep their driving sharp and their appetite for speed on edge by competing in dirt car races in their quest for championship points. The Hoosier 100 at the Indianapolis State Fairgrounds boasts a purse of $67,000. This is a 100-mile dash around a one-mile oval. Notice how the cars slide through turn one, with the left front wheel lifting off the ground. The dirt car race is one of the most exciting spectator sports. This track at Altamont, California, is just one of over 750 sprint and midget tracks in the United States. The sprint car is considered by most drivers to be the most difficult racing machine to handle, with an extremely powerful engine that delivers tremendous acceleration. This form of racing is often wheel to wheel, and if your timing is off, you may lose control and the race. Uh-oh, Seven spins it. Goal of the sprint car rookie is to develop his skill in winning with a smaller car so that one day he can move up to the bigger, low-slung Indianapolis car. In the USAC Championship Series of races, Indianapolis-type race cars compete on road courses or on asphalt ovals like this one at the Phoenix International Raceway. These cars travel over 200 miles per hour on the straightaway. The engines are usually rear-mounted Fords, Offenhausers, or Chevrolets, which develop over 550 horsepower. Top names in the United States, as well as some international Grand Prix drivers, compete in these races for championship points and some of the richest purses in racing. A.J. Foyt, USAC champion, took home a quarter of a million in personal income in 1967. Other drivers like Mario Andretti, Parnelli Jones, Al and Bobby Unser, Gordon John Cox, Jim McElreath, and Lloyd Ruby make up the elite on the championship circuit. Road course like Riverside Raceway near Los Angeles, California. The first annual Rex Mays 300-mile race attracted several European Grand Prix drivers like Jimmy Clark in car number 21. Indy cars are adapted for road racing with a four or five-speed gearbox and the wheels evenly spaced, not offset on one side, which is often preferred in oval racing. This Indy racer, powered by a Ford overhead cam engine, is slightly larger, but the silhouette and performance is much like the European Formula One car. Switches to the Indianapolis Motor Speedway. Here, drivers from all over the world compete for not only the biggest purse in racing, but the fame, glory, and prestige that goes to the winner. The Indianapolis 500 race attracts over 1 million spectators during the month of May, with over 300,000 watching the race in person and over 500,000 viewing the race on closed-circuit theater television. There's a culmination of months of preparation before arrival here. And no matter how impressive the previous record of the car and driver, they must qualify. The top qualifying speed in 1967 was over 169 miles per hour. Even after qualifying, the work that lies ahead is monumental. Mel Kenyon, USAC midget champion, and a respected Indy driver, is wheeled back to his garage, where the car is stripped to the frame, and each and every part of the engine is cleaned and checked for perfection. For some, hope after hope is dashed against the wall as drivers attempt to qualify faster than the year before. Rookies take costly lessons in equipment valued at over $100,000. For some drivers, just qualifying for the 500 is more difficult than racing. It was Parnelli Jones in the Turbine car that showed the way around the track, and especially in the corners with its four-wheel drive. Just a whoosh, and history and headlines were made at the speedway. The Turbine looms as one of the most revolutionary changes at Indianapolis since the rear-engine car replaced the front-engine Roadster. However, only time will reveal its lasting influence at the speedway. Drag racing is relatively small. Years ago in California, where dragging originated, any unused paved strip could be marked off for 1,320 feet or a quarter of a mile and set up for drag racing. In those days,